Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
WFAN and WFAN-FM New York, a radio.com sports station.
Isn't this the point where Minko's supposed to point to me? What is this? What do you get up and run out of the studio? What's going on here? He's so busy on Sunday mornings. Busy with what? Seriously. I've watched him work. It's not that difficult. Oh, all right. Let me be kind. Good morning, everybody. This is Bob Salter. Oh, I know I'm going to get in trouble with him for that one. We are going to have a good program today. I hope you are well. I've been looking forward to our discussion for some time. With the guest who is on with us for both hours of our show today, joined us back in March of this year. And at that time, we planned on the idea that he would be with us, and he was kind enough to join us for the 2 hours of our show today. He is the chairman for Mainstream Mental Health. Dr. John Huber is joining us on our program. He is a clinical forensic psychologist, and we're going to be talking about a number of things regarding mental health. There are so many different areas where potentially we can go in discussion. First of all, it's nice to have you join us again.
Thank you. It's great to be here in studio. I love that.
And very kind of you to come in to the program this morning. What we will do as well is pretty much have the phones open throughout the program today, because we're going to touch upon a number of topics. And I have a feeling some of these are going to strike a chord with some of the folks listening to us. And I always like when we get listeners involved. Sometimes people wait way too late in discussions to try to jump in, and then we're crunched by time and we just don't have a chance to get to them, and that always bothers me. So 877-337-6666 is our number here at The Fan. Now, I want to talk with you about a number of different things, but I'm also going to try to take this discussion, as I always do, from the perspective of someone, and this will be a shocker to you, Dr. Huber, who has never heard us in discussion, okay? And, you know, you and I were talking a half hour or so before the program, and it's like we've known each other for 50 years.
Okay? Exactly.
Because we're able to just jump into a discussion like that. But for somebody who has never heard us talk before, they hear mainstream mental health, they hear a clinical forensic psychologist, and they're thinking, wait a minute, what is all of this? Okay. How do you explain, first of all, what a clinical forensic psychologist is, and secondly, what mainstream mental health is all about?
Well, first of all, I am a clinical psychologist, first and foremost. I'm trained to work with extreme behavioral differences, for lack of a better way to put that. Anything from severe cognitive disabilities to severe mental health issues like schizophrenia, borderline personality disorder. I do a lot of things in those arenas, work with a lot of narcissistic people because I also have that forensic side on me. And the forensic means pertaining to the law. And my training includes doing things like competency to stand trial evaluations. So when you know, a judge or an attorney is like, wait, my client, there's something not right with them. before they can proceed in court, they have to make sure the person understands the consequences of their behaviors. They understand the differences in maybe their reality versus the real world reality, things like that. They understand the judge is assigned or selected by society to be a decision maker for us. And if there's not a jury there, that they also can act as a decision maker. And you start there, and that's kind of the crux of everything. Because once you know a person is competent to stand trial, they're able to do things like plea bargain. They're able to be held accountable for their actions. And if they're not, you have some other things that could be going on. There could be some serious psychosis, for example, going on, and they're not safe. And then the judge turns around and asks someone like me to, hey, is this person really a threat to themselves or others? Changes the nature of my evaluation. I have to usually do more stuff on top of that. And then the judge may look at some kind of a civil commitment, depending on the state they're in, that type of stuff. But basically, it has to do with pertaining to the law. Now, my specific field, I work with some civil and criminal attorneys. I've gone in and worked on double homicides, carjackings in federal court, in state courts. I've done everything from child custody evaluations all the way up to where I'm at in Texas. We, you know, ran for 4 years. We finally decided that took too much manpower for what it's worth, but we were doing the violence risk assessment for adult probation for a couple counties. And so people would come through and the judge would go, is this person safe to let out of our doors and go live with family, maybe on some kind of probation? And we had to make not decisions, the judge ultimately do that, but we had to make recommendations based on actuarial data, you know, stuff. People done research on this, and we know that there's a statistical chance of such and such percent that you will be able to, or you will be able to maintain your life for the next 18 months without getting into a fight with somebody, that kind of stuff. And then the judge looks at that and makes a decision. And right now I'm actually, you know, we've had a lot of mass shootings in schools, and we also have the mass shootings in workplace, and then we have the seductive serial killer. And I've been doing a lot of stuff with that. It started, man, several years ago with, you know, the mass shootings, which actually, when you look at the school shootings, you can go back to almost 1825, I think it is, to one of the first recorded school shootings here in the United States.
Really?
Yes, sir. And it was actually on the last day of that school, and the kid was horsing around. School marm sent him home, and he went and got his deer rifle and came back, and it was a one-room schoolhouse, and everybody in that school was terminated. Oof. So, I mean, these aren't new things. You know, it's just like we think about serial killers. I mean, they go way back. Probably one of the most prolific one was in the early 1900s, late 1800s in Russia. She was a madam of a brothel, and she didn't like men being mean to her girls. And if they did, they would actually go into town, find out if that guy was married, and talk to the wife. And if she was being beaten too, the next time he came in, they would take him out.
Wow.
And it's estimated up to 400 men she took care of.
Oof.
So that's a form of civil justice, right?
Yikes. Wow.
So it never hurts to be kind.
Yes, that's quite true. When we talk about these, you know, these mass shootings, there's an interesting idea that I wanted to touch upon, and this kind of leads us into this perfectly, is this idea of what are referred to, as I understand, as mental health warrants. How would that work as a way to, I guess, try to prevent mass shootings, mass murders?
Well, what we have to understand is, you know, we have some civil rights in this country, mm-hmm. and we want to protect those. So when somebody goes out and says something somewhat threatening, vague, not necessarily specific, somebody sees it, whether it's on Facebook, Instagram, or they're talking about it in front of a bunch of people. They pick up the phone, they call the police. The police come out, and they have to make a decision. Is this, you know, free speech, or is this an actual terroristic threat. The problem is police are police. They're not psychologists. They're not sociologists. And they're being called into place to act like that. And they don't like it. And if they're wrong, you don't like it. You know, I mean, as a civilian. So what can we do to protect that? Mostly what they do at that point is they write a report. This is what was said. We got these statements. This person complained, that kind of stuff. And it goes into a file.
Mm-hmm.
And if we look at the last major school shooter in South Florida, over the previous 2 years, there were something like 18 visits from police officers who legally their hands were tied. There was nothing there. He hadn't actually broken the law.
Mm-hmm.
And if there would have been some way for them to move forward, and working with the judges and stuff that I work with in Central Texas, I started having a dialogue with them. And they talked about there's got to be a way, and they think, you know, we came up with this kind of over a period of months talking with these judges, this idea of a mental health warrant, where now that report can go to a judge if the police officer, like, you know, there's just something not exactly right with this person.
Mm-hmm.
And then send it to the judge. The judge can look at the evidence, the report, and then say, yeah, let's pull that guy in and have him assessed by a forensic psychologist who does things like risk assessment.
Okay, let's hold that thought. I want to come back on this. There's a lot more to get to in discussion. We've got a ton of things to tackle today, and we'll also try to get to calls, 877-337-6666. We're talking with Dr. John Huber on our program on The Fan. Oh, I know I'll be there for that. Good morning, everybody. This is Bob Salter. Brian Rascona is at the controls. We are in discussion with Dr. John Huber on our program. He is a clinical forensic psychologist, chairman for Mainstream Mental Health, and you were talking about this idea of mental health warrants and explaining that, but I'll tell you what. This may take us a bit off that subject in discussion, but I also mentioned the fact that I want to try to open up the phones for people calling. And I know our first caller, Sam in Denver, has been holding forever. Sam, thanks for holding on so long. Welcome to The Fan.
Okay, thank you.
Good morning.
I just wanted to get the doctor's opinion on the use of medicinal marijuana. You know, in New York, I mean, I live in Colorado where everything is legal, but, you know, in New York, I know that it's very, very difficult to get, almost threatened with arrest. And is it fair that the state has this stance to criminalize people for trying to get better for their health?
Well, you know,
I personally have a family member in an upstate New York hospital. I'm trying to get her some oils, and they're threatening to, that's an arrestable offense. And, you know, why does the state need to criminalize people and while every other state is legalizing this?
Well, That becomes a big social issue right there. I do agree with you. I think there's lots of medicinal reasons for a lot of these, not just marijuana, but for other recreational drugs. The research on psilocybin mushrooms and depression. You know, in my own practice with an MD, we do ketamine assisted psychotherapy, ketamine assisted drug rehab. It's amazing some of the success we're having with those. So I know there's lots of value there, but what we have to remember is that, you know, the state is actually us, the people. And just like what happened in Colorado, when the people said, okay, we've had enough, we're tired of being criminalized for something that some of us are using for more than recreational reasons, and we need to have access for that. And, you know, we're doing the same thing in Texas. It's slow in Texas, you know, as you can imagine, right in the Bible Belt. But that's what needs to happen. You know, the people need to stand up and say, hey, this is what we want, and we're going to do it, or we're going to get you out of office. And you have to be really willing to follow through with your threats as a voter. And the question is, are we?
Yeah, I'm really focusing on the state of New York. They seem to have this obsession with criminalizing people, and they've been doing it for years. I'm tending to believe it's the police lobby and the police unions who don't want this legal, and now the politicians are talking about it up in Albany, and you know, they can't wait. They're arguing who's going to get, you know, the hand in the cookie jar. rather, and meanwhile, the prescriptions are incredibly difficult to get in New York. And, you know, it's leaving some patients in a real problem. I mean, do these patients, this particular patient I'm thinking about, do they want to get addicted to Dilaudin and other painkillers while the General Assembly in New York, you know, debates this, while every state, really Massachusetts and every other state, Vermont, has legalized this? I mean, it's what is supposed to be a progressive state is far from progressive. You know, it's run by the cops. I think the cops are pulling a lot of the strings here.
Well, you also need to follow the money, and who's, you know, it's the same reason for prohibition. And once prohibition got lifted, what happened? The tobacco and the alcohol industry went after marijuana and made it illegal. So it's follow the money, and you know, big business has a lot to do with that. The drug companies that have inferior drugs that may or may not do a better job than the marijuana are out there. Look, we can't, you know, capitalize on marijuana like we can on whatever this drug is here, this opiate, whatever. So follow the money and make sure we speak our mind and do it at the voters' booth. Don't just do it on the telephone.
Yeah, and in New York State, it seems to be the three C's. It seems to be, you know, cops, courts, and corrections. And up, especially upstate, that's where the money is, and that's where these state jobs are. And I'm really going back to the fact that I'm really fixated on the state of New York. Mm-hmm. It's insane. In Colorado, the marijuana has has reduced the opioid epidemic, and you know, it's, you got it. It's follow the money. And in New York, it's the money is the state jobs and corrections. And it's really sad.
Sam, thank you for your call this morning. Thank you for your patience on the phone too.
Thank you.
Interesting thoughts you've shared with us. Now before we pause for our update and messages, and listen, people will take us in many different areas here, and that's fine.
Exactly.
I want to try to encourage as many folks as possible who want to join the discussion. Do it. 877-337-6666 is our number here at WFAN. Dr. Huber is with us. He's certainly not afraid to talk with folks listening to us. You were talking about the idea of these mental health warrants and how this kind of developed. I believe you were up to the point where you're talking about working with or talking with judges.
Yes.
About this.
Yes. Because we got to have a gatekeeper, somebody who's mm-hmm. monitoring and, you know, making sure that we're just not picking somebody as a target and a victim. Hey, let's just go after this person. You know, they own a gun. They're crazy. You know, just because you own a gun doesn't make you crazy. Just, you know, we want to protect our rights, our ability to speak our mind, having an official like a judge to step in and say, okay, you know, yeah, this person is speaking their mind, but there's something not quite right there. They're not grounded in reality. There's something off. Let's have somebody who is trained and licensed to do this type of an evaluation and mm-hmm. find out, you know, a lot of times people have the will to do harm to other people, but they absolutely have no means to do that. Whether they're incapacitated somehow, they're disabled somehow, whether, you know, maybe quadriplegic, paraplegic, they can't act on their actions. The government and society doesn't necessarily need to get involved and shut that person down. There's mm-hmm. already, you know, there's already things there. And that may be their only means of communication is by being that extreme in their intent and things like that. You need somebody to clarify, is that really somebody who not only has the will, but the means to follow through with that? And that involves investigation. That's where the police department has already met with these people. And we can follow through. We have that police report with us. It makes it easier for people like myself who are trained to do this to look at those things. Then they present the evidence back to the judge. So it goes back to the judge a second time. And oftentimes that judge is going to be a second judge because they're not working 24 hours a day. You know, they rotate
around.
Exactly,
right.
So now you've got potentially two judges looking at this. The first one who said maybe something's not there. And the second one is saying, okay, now let's look at this report and see if there really is something there or not. And then the judge makes the decision. Again, the psychologist, for example, when I do child custody evaluations, I sit down And I draw a minimum of 5 different profiles for the judge to look at of this parent gets this kid and that kid and these kids. And however, based on this parent's parenting style, this kid has this disability, this other kid doesn't have a disability. Here's their personality types and what we know about actual base rates of interactions between parents with different personality types and children with different personality types versus parenting style. We do essentially the same thing. We present those different profiles. Here is the likelihood based on these dated, you know, research-driven tools we have. And the judge then has an ability to make an informed consent. Okay, maybe this person just says, hey, you go out. We're going to monitor you for 6 months. If you get out and go see a therapist, you know, once a month or every whatever the judge deems, it's amazing how they become good physicians and start ordering medicine and things like that in the courtroom. But they do it because, you know, society gives them the power, and doctors aren't going to say you have to take this medicine because there's this ethical thing that doctors have that say we can't force you to take medication. A judge can. Society says the judge can deem that necessary. So how do you take a different medicine? That all depends too, because if you can't swallow a certain medicine and you don't want to take it, it's kind of hard for a doctor sometimes to give it to you.
So if somebody is refusing to comply with an order, they wind up being in contempt? Would that
They would wind up in contempt, and what would happen at that point, the thought is the judge can go ahead and order the assessment because they are in contempt of court. Mm-hmm. They pull them into the courthouse or the jail county lockup, and then someone like myself would go in there and do an evaluation there, and then they've complied with their court order, and they can walk out the door of the jail.
Dr. John Huber is talking with us on our program On the Fan this Sunday morning. Back to the phone we go at 877-337-6666. Jose in the Bronx is up next. Jose, good morning. Welcome to the Fan.
Good morning.
Hey, good morning. Good morning, doctor. I usually turn in the morning to listen to the sports, and today I find myself listening to you guys and the previous caller, and I'm fascinated by the stuff. I'm actually working in a psych ward myself, and
it's a tough job, man.
A doctor.
Thank you.
I'm just a patient care tech, you know. Yes. And every day we see what's going on, and every day we see patients or recipients coming through the doors, and it's the revolving door. And we push this medication down the throat that we have no guarantee that's going to work, and you know, actually we can almost say that they're going to return. I mean, we can almost guarantee that they will return. And a lot of times, you know, I know that the doctor there and a lot of other doctors, because I'm a marijuana user myself, but, you know, you guys, especially in this state, can say, go smoke a joint, you feel better afterwards. But I know that you guys could, if you guys, you know, if the laws change here, especially in New York. I see a lot of people who take psychotics, or who take psychotic medication and all this stuff that would be a lot better off if they just smoke a joint, you know, in my personal opinion. But, you know, observing the recipients come back and you know, every day, you know, I just feel like this whole situation is not for the betterment of the recipient. It's all money, and it's not the right thing, though.
Well, Jose, I think there's a whole lot going on that you're right. In my state and in the state of New York, we can't say, go smoke a joint, you'll feel better. But I do know there's research out there that depending upon what your issue is, whether it's anxiety, depression, that type of stuff, that for the mental health side, that the marijuana can help. But it's actually not for everybody, and there's different strains of marijuana. For example, we've seen certain strains of marijuana that actually makes your anxiety worse. And believe it or not, the people who know best about that are the people who work in the legal dispensaries. You can go in there and they'll tell you, oh, if you have anxiety, don't take this strain. You want this one over here.
I agree with that. But all I'm saying is that if I was born in this country and raised in this country, I know for a fact that I would have been diagnosed with at least ADHD or some type of anxiety. And I know I would never dare to take any kind of medication for that. But, you know, ever since I started smoking, my life has gotten better. And my personal life, my marriage, and everything else.
Good for you.
So, yeah, so I that's why I can say that with such certainty, because I myself experience it, and I also see patients who just take their regular medication, and there is no betterment for that recipient.
Jose, thank you for your call this morning. Do appreciate it.
You're welcome.
877-337-6666 is our phone number here at The Fan this Sunday morning. He's on deadline. Well, good morning, everybody. This is Bob Salter. We're in discussion with Dr. John Huber on our program. Dr. Huber is a clinical forensic psychologist. He's the chairman for Mainstream Mental Health, and he's in studio with us on our program today, sharing a lot of information. We're talking about a variety of different topics surrounding mental health. We're going to get into some other interesting areas of discussion. And what I've said we will do also is to try to take in some thoughts from some of the folks listening to us. 877-337-6666 is our number here at The Fan. You wanted to mention something before we take our next caller.
Exactly. I am here tonight, actually, at 5:30. Between 5:30 and 6, we start at Comic Strip Live. It's New York's funniest reporter, and I'll be hosting that, and I'll actually be there with someone I consider my friend. In fact, I was just on the phone with him last week, a gentleman, Jerry Cooney, the amazing boxer, who has come on my show several times and talked about his experiences with depression and alcoholism and how he's dealt with that over the years. And he's struggling alcoholic, and he had his last drink in 1988, and he'll still tell you, you know, he's got to think about it every day, and it's a challenge. So just come on out and support us. In fact, in honor of one of our other calls, I think I'm going to wear a prison orange. I have some amazing prison orange scrubs that I wear at the hospital because it kind of breaks the ice with my patients, and I think this morning's caller helped me make a decision as to what I'm going to wear on stage today. So, and I do a few jokes myself, and my kids are in town, and they're like, "Do we have to go? We've heard all your jokes. Do we have to go?" And the funny thing is, they're the ones who I joke about most of the time, and it's actually funnier when they're there because they start heckling me. That's not what happened, you know.
Nice.
You know how teenagers
nice.
Are.
Nice. So. Subtle. Well, let's hope for a very successful night tonight.
Thank you.
With that, too. Back to the phones we go. 877-337-6666 is our number. Jim has been holding in New Jersey for a long time. Jim, thanks for holding on so long. Welcome to The Fan.
Hey, Jim.
Hi, Doctor. I'm calling you because my wife has fibromyalgia, and she's on Cymbalta and
I lost him.
Whoops.
They're not working anymore. In the beginning, it was working, and then it got less effective and less effective. And I was wondering if there's any other kind of alternative medication she could take to help with the symptoms, with the pain and the fogginess of her brain, you know, the fibro fog, they call it, where she has, she has some depression issues with it and a lot of confusion and stuff with the fibromyalgia.
Absolutely. And you need to always consult with a licensed physician in your state, in your neighborhood, somebody you're comfortable with, but you should take different things to them. For example, in my clinic, again, I work with a medical doctor. I'm a PhD psychologist, and we actually have several chronic pain patients with fibromyalgia, and we've been able to mediate a lot of their pain using ketamine and ketamine-assisted psychotherapy. Now, not everybody and everybody's willing to do this. Pain medication doctors should be familiar with ketamine and its potential value, but it also, in fact, they just recently allowed to go to market a new ketamine nasal spray for depression. So, I mean, we know it is significant. Now, there's lots of research out there to support that. There's lots of research out there on pain management with ketamine, and it's not the cure-all. It's not going to work for everybody. And in fact, in my practice, one of the things we know it's inappropriate for certain mental health issues and personality types. So we require them to get a psychological evaluation before we do it, just to make sure we don't have problems or create problems with the ketamine. We want to be as safe as possible. And it is a safe medication. We use it in child surgeries, you know, with little kids, because we don't necessarily want to give them a regular general that may keep them out for hours. This has a half-life of 10 or 15 minutes, and it's over in about 40.
Yeah, because like I said, between Cymbalta and Lyrica, it's not doing it anymore.
There's a lot of reasons for that, and what you're talking about is neuroleptic pain, and that is pain that's caused by the nerve cells themselves. And regular types of opiate pain medications don't work very well for that. We've had some success with about 3 out of 4 of our patients with fibromyalgia in my clinic in Texas. I can't guarantee you, because you know we have a very systematic way. Not everybody administers the medication the way we do, but I know, because there's lots of research coming out of New York and like that on ketamine. There are people around here who do that. You're just going to have to do some exploration. And I would start with your own physician. And if they don't give you the answer you like, keep moving forward and educate yourself.
Okay, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Travel safely, Jim. Thanks for your patience on the phone. Next up, we go to Tom in Westchester. Tom, good morning. Welcome to the Fan.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I'm not sure this is his expertise, the doctor, but my question involves that I'm on heavy pain medication for stenosis and for having titanium rods in my back. And recently, they've been cutting back on the pain medication because of the opiate crisis throughout the country, which I understand entirely. It's way out of control and has to be curbed. My problem is, and I've talked to my doctors about this, is nowhere from the government have I seen or read what they're doing for people who are in need of medication, and then now curtailing that, and the mental strain that it has caused me has increased the pain and my ability to handle my problem right now. And I'm just wondering, have you heard anything from the government that is allowing people who have legitimate reasons to be able to receive pain medication? Because my doctors tell me they're trying to curb it and push everyone towards therapy and marijuana, and they have
that's pretty much what's happening. It's a knee-jerk reaction, and they're taking some patients who have been on pain medications because they need it, not because they're necessarily addicted. But your body develops a tolerance with those medications, so you have to keep managing that. And if you've been with a pain doctor for a long time, there's a likelihood you're on some really high doses of medication, and the government has come through and just kind of done a blanket across the board, no more than this medication, no more that
which
medication.
Which I understand entirely, but
there's a reason for it, but there's also a reason for doctors practicing medicine and working with their patients and getting them the help they need.
Yeah, but they tell me their hands are tied.
They are, actually. That's across the nation.
It's been a blanket movement throughout the country, and you have no.
And with the titanium rods, we've actually had several patients come through with that. And again, it's using the ketamine, and what that does is those tiny titanium rods are emitting or causing a constant pain. It's there all the time. Is that not correct?
And my back is fused too, so I have a number of things.
Exactly. So what's happening is body, that's your new normal, and the ketamine helps reset your brain to say that's normal. Don't receive that as a pain message anymore. And
would
you
have a recommendation besides that for me to ask them about?
I would recommend that you start doing research. Ketamine is K-E-T-A-M-I-N-E. And I would look for clinics
in
here.
In that avenue? Yeah.
Yeah. And because I wasn't planning on having a ketamine clinic discussion this morning. So
I'm
it's a good question, though. And it's something that I do in my practice. And I know what we do and what we do back in Texas. And,
well, let me just tell you, before they curtailed the medication, I was able to function, go out. I'm a retired person, and I was able to be active in my life. Since they cut on my medication, I've become much more sedentary because of the pain, because I can't walk as much because of the pain. And now I'm just barely getting around. And it, to me, it just seems somewhere along the line, the government has to say X amount of people are legitimate in their, you know, true pain.
Absolutely. And I can say as a chronic pain person myself, sports injuries from when I was a teenager, that, you know, after 30 years of that, I used the ketamine, and with the doctor I currently use with my practice, he convinced me to try it because I was very skeptical, and I used it myself.
Your lifestyle, Doc?
I don't take opiates anymore. Period. And going on three years, and you know, I have steel pins in my shoulder. I was using Synvisc in my knees. I love the stuff. It allowed me function.
And oxycodone, which are, I know, very heavy, but I've been on them for a number of years, but they did allow me to function as a normal human being for a while.
And that's what
happens. But now, this blanket statement across the board of cutting all medications, it's
nationwide.
I don't know. It seems very drastic for people who are in need of it, you know?
I agree.
Tom, thank you for your call this morning. Certainly good luck as you continue. Thank you for bringing that to our attention.
And thank you guys very much for taking the call.
Thank you, Tom.
Yep.
Bye-bye.
Have a good day now. Next up, we go to Gary in Colts Neck, New Jersey, who's been holding for a while. Gary, thanks for holding on so long. Welcome to the fan.
Thank you. Good morning. I'm just turned on the radio a little while ago. Beautiful out here. And got a question. I was out of work for a little over a couple of years. I'm a landscaper. Not a good one, but I'm a landscaper.
Honestly,
actually, I've been doing it a long time, 33 years, you know, and, you know, it's crazy, but I never thought I'd ever recover, to be totally honest with you. I had neuro Lyme disease.
Wow.
It was so bad for me. I was an athlete growing up. Bang up your body, you get used to living with pain.
Right.
So nobody wants to hear you, your wife, your kids. So what do? You take some Advil, whatever. At the end of the day, it's the norm, the new norm. Well, I'm 51 years old. All I could tell you is I went through so many different doctors. No one knew what I had. Every year I get tested for Lyme disease. Everything comes back negative, negative, negative. Oh, it's great. Your cholesterol is great. Your triglycerides are great. And you're negative on Lyme. Well, believe it or not, I went to a doctor and I had three bands of Lyme: mycoplasma, parvovirus, herpes 6, all from the bacteria in my body. But I had Epstein-Barr virus when I was a young kid. And let me tell you, that starts the whole process of the immune system shutting down. Well, I got infected by a tick or ticks. Who the heck knows? I had them on me. You pull them off. I don't know. You can't find these things. Sometimes they could be in your back of your head. You don't know. Your groin area, you never looked.
Mm-hmm.
So I was on all kinds of things, medication. They threw this, that, all kinds of wacky stuff. I got off everything, and I just did it with a little bit of CBD oil without marijuana in it. I'm all for medical marijuana, and I could have been on it. I chose not to, only because I had to try to still work in between, and I just didn't like the feeling of being,
absolutely,
you know, dopey all day. So my thing is that people can't drive as it is, and what I'm worried about, I'm all for marijuana legally for medical. But if doctors out there decide to just give this, and that to everybody, I'm very concerned. You know, I just think they're going to abuse the whole thing. Just because I chose not to go that route, I did things differently, cutting out my gluten, cutting out my sugars, mold I had in my house, alcohol occasionally. I don't drink alcohol at all. Let me tell you what, I feel tremendous. At the end of the day, I never thought Gary would be back.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm so clear. I just worry about people because I hear this every day. Everybody's in pain and pain and pain. I just think if they just start cutting out all their gluten and sugars alone, because I had spirochetes running rampant in my body. I detox my body every day. And let me tell you, I feel unbelievable. I feel like I'm 20 years old, but I can't do things like I used to do, obviously. But mentally, I'm just so clear on everything.
That's great.
I really love this conversation that I'm hearing on the radio, because it's like everybody's hurting,
mm-hmm,
and all they want to do is give drugs. I don't get it. So thank you for listening to me, and I just hope people out there could just start.
Oops,
we lost them.
We lost him, and I think that was my fault. I'm sorry, Karen. I think I hit the button by accident there. I'm sorry. Interesting comments in hour one of our program. Yes, it's hour one because our guest is with us for both hours of our show today, Dr. John Huber. We really just started in some of the areas of discussion where I wanted to go with him. He is chairman for Mainstream Mental Health. He is talking with us on our program on The Fan, both hours this Sunday morning.
WFAN and WFAN-FM New York, a radio.com sports station.
Oh, I love when he comes in here. You know, he's such, first of all, he's such a handsome young man. Very, very handsome young man.
That's
and
true.
He's very, very well spoken. I've always thought that
about
him.
I don't know about that part.
No, he is.
But I am.
What
nice
do you mean
handsome,
he's not? That wasn't a nice thing for you to say. You know, at times I think you're really not a nice person. Actually, wait a minute. You've said that about me.
Yes, I have.
I knew I had heard it somewhere. Mink, it's so good to have you here with
I'm
us.
Here to monitor. You
I know
I'm
you
set by the program director
oh,
to monitor this situation.
Believe me, I hear from him. Ay, 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 ay. And I know he wants you here monitoring on Sunday.
Oh, absolutely.
Morning. Not every Sunday.
No.
But here every once in a while.
Yeah.
Just to keep me on
keep
my
thinking,
toes.
That's correct. That's a good assessment on your part. And you're a good-looking fella, too.
Aw, thanks. After our 8 o'clock update, speaking of good-looking fellas, it is Rick Wolf who is along with the Sports Edge program. After our 9 o'clock update, Ed Randall will be along. He'll be talking baseball here on The Fan. We're in discussion with Dr. John Huber on our program. Dr. Huber is chairman for Mainstream Mental Health, which is a nonprofit organization on the web, by the way, at mainstreammentalhealth, that's all as one word, .org. And we've been talking about a number of things in the area of mental health. We've gotten into other areas of discussion as well, too. I'd said that what we would do over the course of the 2 hours is try to talk to as many people on the phone who want to join us in discussion as we possibly can. 877-337-6666 is our number here at The Fan. We're going to get into a discussion talking about some concerns around suicide in just a couple of moments, but let's do another call here before we shift in discussion. Rob has been holding in Lake Success for what must seem
Bob,
like forever.
Always a great show, and listen, being as a regular caller to the station, you know, you put yourself out there, but I talked about this on your particular show where you had the neuroanatomist as well as the orthopedist periodically. And my situation is, doctor, I happen to be a physician, but I woke up in June of 2016, 3 years ago, overnight, went to bed normal, and woke up in the morning deaf in my right ear, completely
wow.
Lost my hearing. Sadly, I'm one of 5,000 people in the country, or actually worldwide, that this happens to every year. It's a very unusual condition. They think it happened from a virus. They don't really know. Bottom line is, I was treated ASAP. Nothing happened. It's a very poor treatment as far as I took steroids, prednisone,
yes.
For a couple weeks, and that's the form of treatment. Nothing happened. Ultimately, I'm helping mankind now. I was selected as one of the few people in the world to get a cochlear implant, single-side deafness, meaning I hear two different sides. I hear two different types of hearing, doctor.
Yes.
I hear electrical hearing, which is a cochlear implant. Now, they've been around since the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And believe it or not, people think that a cochlear implant restores your hearing. It does not. I'm deaf. I take it off. I'm not wearing it now. When I put it on, I hear similarly, like when people have a voice box, a tracheotomy, they put that prosthetic device on that they can talk through the prosthetic device.
Correct.
It's an electrical type sound with a normal acoustic hearing. But here's my I've learned to accept that part of it. Here's the problem that I unfortunately I have to live with the rest of my life. And other than going to drugs, which I would never do. One, I'm a competitive athlete and still compete. I'm a distance runner at a very high level. So I don't take anything. But I have tinnitus as soon as I lost my hearing.
Wow.
The tinnitus is 24/7 non stop in the one ear. So over time, you just learn to. It's my new me. I heard one of your previous callers say your new me. And the thing is, you know, I help other people in the deaf community, and I talk to them about it. And the deaf world, most of them don't have tinnitus because they've been born deaf. They don't know what sound is. They have cochlear implants, and it's a wonderful thing for them because right. They can hear again. Someone like myself, this is horrible because I went to bed normal and I woke deaf. So they don't understand. And who I help mainly are the few people like myself. They have reached out to me on the internet, and I speak with them, and I consult them, and I send them in the right direction. But my problem is myself, meaning, you know, it's part of life. How do you treat tinnitus without drugs, any type of drug type? I'm not going to go down that road. Is this something that I'm going to have to just learn to accept forever, which I have? Maybe it's 3 years already, and I was, you know, it was tough a couple of years ago. When you wake up, you go out of your mind. I mean, you know, what's going on? I thought I had a stroke. But as right. It was, is the hearing just shut down. There's a small artery in the cochlea, which is the size of a pea, which basically is the control of your hearing, the blood supply, and it just probably just shut down over time. And for whatever reason, I they don't really know.
Right.
How do you treat tinnitus?
You have nerve damage from that death.
The people say tinnitus is something, it's a noise in your head. But what I hear, everybody has different types of sound.
Right.
Mine is kind of like a dial tone 24/7. Imagine picking up the phone and you hear a dial tone, and that's what you hear every day, 24/7. But, well, listen, you learn to accept it, and you kind of block it. Now, when I put my cochlear implant on, my device, okay, uh-huh. The prosthetic, it takes it away.
Well,
but I can't wear it 24/7. Number one, then
correct.
I got to deal with the other condition of hearing two different sounds. I've got to say, okay, now I got the electrical side,
wow.
and that's why I'm a study. It's not even FDA approved. They haven't. People in my condition, they go for the cochlear implant, not for the hearing aspect. They go for it for the tinnitus because the hearing is something that they're not even sure if it's a good treatment. Meaning, you know, in the United States of America, I'm in a test of maybe a couple hundred people in the country
mm-hmm.
that have this device because they don't know if electrical hearing with acoustic hearing is a good match. I find it's okay. I've accepted it. I get used to it. But I can't live with the device all the time. And how do you deal without taking any form of drugs? And I'm not going down that road. Is it just something my brain will just have to, over time, as time continues, the new normal me will just accept it 100%?
Well, it sounds a lot like phantom pain. That
say, well, but here's the thing. That's correct. But the doctors say that. But I really believe in the center, in the hearing center, in the brain. What happens is the ear is open. It's been open for 55 years of my life at the time when I lost my hearing, and it shuts down. So it's like the brain wants to hear.
That's kind of what happens with phantom pain. You don't actually have a stimulus
right.
there,
when
but
people
your brain
have
is so used to having stimulus there that it kind of creates its own.
Right, the brain is creating its own stimulus.
Right.
That's exactly what's going on.
So, you know, staying away from medicine, I would explore some form of hypnosis. I know it works great for pain, and if you have a good hypnotherapist who can take that, because essentially that tone is driving you crazy.
Well, you know what,
painful
it is
in a psychological
you know,
sense.
Doctor, let me put it this way. And if anybody's listening out there who's heard me as a caller, if you have hearing issues, you know, get it treated. And if you're one of the few people like myself that have lost the hearing in one ear, the cochlear implant is a wonderful way to get
yes.
to restore a form of hearing and to get rid of the tinnitus. But you don't, you know, I'm unfortunately one of the unlucky ones and freaky people out there. And the sad thing is that these people like myself that are living with this noise and they have not had an implant, okay, to block it or distract it, or mask it is a better way. There are some people that are having a rough time out there and they've contemplated what you're talking about, you know, suicide and things like that. Fortunately, I'm a pretty strong person mentally. I that's never been a thought. But other than hypnosis, I guess what I'm asking you, doctor, is something that the brain over time, because people have lots of problems in life. We all deal with pain.
Right.
It's a form of pain in a way. I look at it that way. I mean, but it's a mental pain, in one respect, being that it's not physical. Is
okay,
it something?
Rob, take a breath for a second. Let him actually respond to you.
unfortunately, it's probably going to be there forever for you. Much like my patients who come to me with phantom pain in amputations, that type of stuff. Everybody's different. There's always outliers. You know, and I say start at hypnosis. Hypnosis may not be it for you. But, you know, there's new studies. You know, CBD oil, everybody blows up. Oh, it's the perfect. It cures everything. And I've seen it do amazing things for some of my patients with seizure disorders. But that doesn't mean it's going to cure everything, and it doesn't cure everybody with seizures. There's finally actually university studies going on, so we can look and see if it actually is causal for this type of stuff, or if it's just kind of like, hey, you know, the human body kind of repairs itself anyhow, so it was at the CBD oil, or it just was going to get better anyhow. With your type, I mean, you're talking about, again, a very specific situation. I don't know enough about that to say what's going on. And, you know, the tinnitus is kind of a type of sound stimulated by the brain. It's neurological. There's no stimulus there. And you need to keep doing what you're doing, what works for you. But I would explore other avenues. You don't want to use drugs.
No.
Then definitely I would start with hypnosis. And you got to realize not every hypnotherapist is a good hypnotherapist or the best one for you. Just because it doesn't work for somebody else at that place doesn't mean you won't benefit.
My last comment, and thank you for bringing this kind of topic to the audience, Bob. I think it's interesting and fascinating. Everybody has different things. My thought is hopefully over time, because I've almost forgot what it feels like to have bilateral hearing again, normal acoustic hearing. I think it's, as time goes on, it's going to get less and less as the years pass in my life. I'll have totally forgotten what it is, and I'm just, you know, hoping that this is just something that over time it'll get so... It just be a part of my right side of my head that I just don't think about it all anymore. It's just part of my normal, you know, me. And
Rob,
and
Rob, we got to go here.
All right, thank you very much, Bob. I appreciate for giving me the time.
Thank you very much for your call, your patience on the phone. We're going to talk more with Dr. John Huber as we continue on our program on The Fan this Sunday morning.
And this is something that we have to talk about. This isn't something that we can just keep in whispered tones and not have the conversation. This has to be open. We need everyone in this agency to be willing to talk about this. This is a problem not only in the NYPD, but all over law enforcement in this country. Besides the two that we lost, a Philadelphia police officer just today lost his life to suicide. It is imperative that we have conversations. There is help available. Reach out. Reach out within this agency, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We have someone that you can speak to. If you're afraid to go through this agency, go externally. Get the help.
That is the voice of Terrence Monahan, who is the chief of the department in New York City Police Department. He has got us started in this segment of our program on The Fan. I'm Bob Salter. We have Dr. John Huber in studio with us. He's been with us since we started our show at 6 o'clock this Sunday morning. After our 8 o'clock update, Rick Wolf is along with the Sports Edge program. Ed Randall's Talking Baseball follows our 9 o'clock update. And we shift now into a discussion on this topic of mental health, talking about New York City Police Department and this move to really bring the discussion out of the shadows when you get right down to it. This follows the suicides of two veteran city cops within a couple-day period. And literally, this, as I understand, shook things up in the department, as you would imagine. There was a suicide of a police officer in Philadelphia. And again, we get into an area of discussion where many times, Dr. Huber, people do not want to go there, okay? And this is one of the great dilemmas in our society.
Absolutely.
Because suicide is something that is a factor in the lives of many people, whether it's concerns about suicide, it's the people who will say that they have attempted suicide at points in their lives. Then there are the people who have known folks who have committed suicide. And many of us do. Whether it's a family member, a close friend, could be somebody you knew from the sports world, somebody you knew from the entertainment world, a news figure. This idea of, to go back to what I was saying at the very beginning of my comments here, bring this out of the shadows. What's your reaction to what Chief Monahan is saying? Because he seems to be putting it out there and basically prodding members of his department to get help.
Well, and that's what should happen. You know, it comes from the top. And unfortunately, you know, first responders, police officers, firemen, EMS, your emergency room doctors, nurses, mm-hmm. you know, they get hit with stuff all the time. And they see people at their worst, not because of something they wanted to have happen. And in this case, you know, you can't save everybody. You get frustrated. The world piles up on top of you. And it's much more than just being depressed. And everybody's had grief. They've lost something. When patients talk to me about this suicide thought, you know, they feel like at that moment the only option is that. There's no coming back. And they're totally despondent. They think they're such a burden on their family, friends, neighborhood, everybody else, that they're only doing society a favor by doing this. I mean, everything is so skewed in their perception of things. And we have to get out there and talk about it. It's the whole idea for mainstream mental health. I mean, we have to get out there and talk about these things so people aren't afraid. They think somehow it means you're broken, and what it means is you're a human being. You care about things. You care about your life. You care about other people's lives. And you get despondent. You just and things shut down. We gotta have it on the front burner. And I think that's exactly what the chief's doing. And I think that's what needs to happen, but it needs to be every day. It needs to be, you know, before they have their meeting in the morning, before they walk out the door. And there are resources, you know, you don't have to do it within house, whether you're working at you know, RCA, Motorola, CBS, whoever, or the police department. You know, right here in your own city, you've got a suicide hotline. It's 212-673-3000. Nationwide hotline. It's 1-800-273-TALK. Real simple. And, you know, the Covenant House, 1-800-999-9999. It's real simple. They're not going to fix your problems, but there's people out there who care. We don't want you to terminate whatever's going on. And once that happens, there's nothing we can do to help you.
Right.
And you just pass it on. The people who know you then are psychologically given your burdens. I mean, it's the burdens don't end. It's a difficult thing to realize, but when I talk with families, when I talk with suicide survivors, people who pulled the trigger and survived the gunshot wound, you know, took the overdose and survived the overdose. And there's a study that was out a few years ago from people who jump off the Golden Gate Bridge and survive. And 100% of those people are like, what was I thinking? Nothing was so bad. But they don't realize that until after they pull the trigger. They don't realize it until they miss the net going over the edge of the Golden Gate Bridge. And what that tells me is everybody else who didn't survive was having that same thought as they were going away and they were perishing. That's got to be even worse when you have that instant understanding right then. But the second before then, the only option they had was that. So, you know, we have to go back and look at family and friends. And they talk to me, oh, somebody comes to you as suicidal. What do you do? Well, there's only certain things I can do. I mean, if somebody wants to take their life, I have seen patients try so many different ways. And, you know, we may talk about them just because we talk about them today. They already thought of them. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not teaching anybody anything they don't know.
Right.
You know, so if you don't have a bridge to jump off, you don't have a building to jump off of, you can hang yourself. Anthony Bourdain's perfect example. Use the belt of a robe. Okay. I mean, you know, what do we do with prison inmates we worry about? We take away their socks, their belts, their shoestrings, their underwear, anything that can be used to strangle themselves with. But what else do they do? Well, they climb up on anything they can get any kind of height on, and they take swan dives into the concrete floor trying to break their necks. Mm-hmm. They run across the cell slamming their heads up against the bars as hard as they can. It is, you know, if something they want to do, they're going to find a way to try and do it. So I make them do the contract knowing that, you know, if the judge does not commit them because of my recommendation or whatever, or whatever civil commitment we do to protect people like this, that if they walk out the door, that contract's not going to keep them from killing themselves if they really want to. That contract is what ethics and what law says I have to do, and it basically protects me as a practitioner. And it really doesn't do much for the client, you know. But when I've done everything I can do, the judge has done everything they can do.
Right.
Unfortunately, that's what I have left. So we have to get to people before they get to that point. And that's where talking about depression, talking about these things long ahead of time are important. I mean, we lose between 120 and 140 people every day in this country to suicide. Far greater than most places have homicides. I mean, we lose about 36 to 38,000 people a year just off of homicides. Yet we get about double that with suicides in this country.
You know, it's the figures are amazing. And to go back to something you mentioned a couple of moments ago, talking about the situation in San Francisco, California with the Golden Gate Bridge. I mean, there's a whole, I hate to use this word because I'm not trying to glorify this, but there's a phenomenon surrounding this idea of the number of people who have jumped off the Golden Gate Bridge. I mean, first of all, I could never even conceive of something like
absolutely
that. Okay. I just could not. Okay. But just the idea that this has its own legacy and the like, that's
well, you know, it's funny, and funny in a science kind of way, not like ha ha funny,
right,
that kind of stuff. But you know, the opposite of depression is not happiness, it's resilience. Being able to just deal with everything. And when you lose that ability for whatever reason, stress, you know, medical issues, mm-hmm, whatever, you know, you become less and less resilient as that happens. And at some point, the only pathway that you find is termination. And it's bizarre when I see a 14-year-old who's, you know, the highest group for women right now is 10 to 14 years of age. That's the highest attempt rate, not necessarily success rate. That's a scary thing, you know. These are our future mothers like that, and we're seeing rates as high as 20% attempting, 1 in 5, you know, and that young.
Bullying, body shaming. I mean, there's a whole
social media.
Well, yeah.
Well, now, because all that body shaming, the bullying, we used to get a break. We'd go home. Mom and dad weren't doing that in most cases, right?
Mm, hopefully not.
Hopefully not. There are a few. We know the realities of it. But now you never leave it. You got your cell phone. You got your instant messaging. You got your tablet. And you never leave that. It's always there. But the reality of it is, and what it boils down to, you make a decision. Those people didn't make the decision for you. Mm-hmm. And it goes down to resilience, coping skills, and we as family members and friends need to help encourage that resilience Because if we go after, oh, quit being so depressed. Well, if it was that easy, they would have already done that. So you start talking about what skills they do have and introduce how they can use the skills they have to make themselves stronger. And because they can't always see their skills. They can't always see the things they have because they're so despondent.
Mm. And then there's the whole thing of the peer pressure.
Absolutely.
Around that age, too. And one group we have not mentioned, and some of the people listening to us may literally be screaming back at their radios.
Yes.
Because very often we hear it stated, and the figures seem to always be in the 20s, the number of veterans who commit suicide every day.
An average is about 22 a day nationwide.
I want you to think about this because we're going to take a pause for some messages and we'll get Mr. Minko's updates in. When we come back, I want you to talk with us about, I guess, where we are with that and also how it is we as a society go about getting a handle on that a priority. Because to me, that's an atrocity. And I really don't understand why it is that that doesn't seem to be a real priority. So we'll tackle that when we come back. We're talking with Dr. John Huber on our program. You want to join the conversation, 877-337-6666. It's Sunday morning on The Fan. After our 8 o'clock update, Rick Wolf is along with the Sports Edge. Ed Randall's Talking Baseball is along after our 9 o'clock update this Sunday morning. We are in a discussion, as we have been since we started our show at 6 this morning, with Dr. John Huber. He is chairman for Mainstream Mental Health. Mainstream Mental Health, that's all as one word, .org, the website. He's a clinical forensic psychologist, and he's talking with us on our program. What I said we would do as well is to take some calls from some of the folks listening to us, 877-337-6666. Before we paused for our update and messages, I had asked about the situation with veteran suicides and how it is that we, I guess, start to get a handle on this, make this a priority. And the other aspect of this is, how bad is the situation facing vets who want help?
The situation is overwhelming for most of them, actually. I mean, you know, you come from a culture, the military, where if you have a mental health issue, even something as simple as grief and loss, you know, like say you have a family member who dies, passes away while you're active duty, you know, you become a potential liability in the battlefield. So instead of trying to remediate that and help you get through that, you know, they tend to ostracize. And the last thing you want to do is not be with, you know, your brothers.
Right.
You know, and so you hide it. You don't say anything. You become angry and aggressive because that's the socially acceptable emotion men can have, especially in the military, but in general across this country. And it you know, can make you a better warrior, you know, and look good in your eyes to your peers. The problem is when you come home and the world, hopefully in your living room, is not a battlefield. And unfortunately, you're still trained that way. And I, you know, on, you know, what can we do with it? I would really love to see a 4-week boot camp to become a civilian again. You know, we do it. It makes you a boot camp and it makes your survival chances so much significantly higher by doing boot camp. We know that. Military's been doing it for hundreds of years because it increases your survivability. But you get a nice little 30-minute interview and they send you out the door. Everything okay? You depressed? You having nightmares? You know, just about every one of the veterans I've worked with has been having nightmares. Mm-hmm. And they had them at a point and they, oh, I can handle it. It's not that big deal. But 5 years later when they're still going and they finally are at their wit's end, They walk in to go see somebody at the Veterans Administration. And it's not that they don't want to help you. It's just they don't have enough people there to provide the services. And depending upon where you're at across the country, times vary. I do get reports in certain areas that, hey, you know, I was able to get in a day or two or that day. But, you know, you're talking about a culture that is very fearful of mental health illness. So they don't really want to go to the local emergency room because they won't understand the military history and maybe some of the things that they've seen. You know, but you'd be surprised how many veterans are working right there as physicians and ER physicians and nurses. So you shouldn't be afraid to do that, but that's part of what happens. And they want to go see other military personnel. However, I get reports that they felt like they were still this liability, even with medical professionals. And they're ready to get help then, and they get told, even if it's just a few weeks. But there are some places I've been told by people who call in and leave me messages or email me that some places it's as high as 13 months because their local VA is so overwhelmed. It's not because they don't want to help. It's just the manpower. And then we have to look at the whole other side of the feminine issue. You know, we have women out there who gave everything to serve this country. And they don't want to be the woman who is the reason why some politician says, okay, women can't fight and be in combat areas anymore. So there, the research is showing up to 200% less likely to go get mental health care as a veteran than a civilian woman is, because they don't want to be that poster child for not letting women into battle, because that's what one of the things they wanted to do. You know, that you have that drive, and if somebody tells you, no, you can't do it, talk about dehumanizing you and making you less. And they don't want to be that poster child, because there are other women out there who feel that same way, just like there are men out there who do that exact same thing. It's a tough situation.
Dr. John Huber is who we are talking with on our program on The Fan this Sunday morning. Rick Wolf and The Sports Edge follows our 8 o'clock update. Let's go back to the phone. 877-337-6666 is our number. Bob has been holding in Little Ferry, New Jersey since, well, I think when he went on hold, General Washington was going across New Jersey, I believe, at that time. Good morning, Bob. Welcome to The Fan.
Good morning, and good morning, Dr. Huber.
Good morning, Bob.
I would like to start the phone call by saying that I did have Sir Winston, and I've been on hold ever since Sir Winston won, telling everybody in the family that I won the Belmont Stakes.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Dr. Huber, quickly, is suicide a crime legally?
You know, whenever we harm anybody in our society, you know, we try to criminalize it. The reality of it is, you know, we say it's illegal because we don't want you taking human life. I have never seen anybody prosecuted for attempting to kill themselves. I've never seen somebody get charged. Now, I'm not saying it hasn't happened. I've just never seen a judge sit there and actually charge somebody.
All right, but let's leave it at that. I understand. I just asked the question kind of rhetorically, but they said what you did. I believe, and I don't have any statistics to back this up, but I believe people of poverty, people that struggle in lives, people that have families and, oh, so many problems, we couldn't even list them in 10 pages of writing their life story, have a low record of suicide. Yet the people that are affluent or that have a lot to live for, isn't it crazy that it's a higher percentage of those people committing suicide? I truly believe a couple of things, that people that in their own minds believe that they are expected to produce so much more from their lives. And if, in fact, they don't seem to be able to believe that they are, in fact, doing that, it starts the cycle of where they go, my God, I'm coming up short. I don't know what to do. I'm a loss. And to tie in with what you said about the GIs, Bob, when you brought that up, to me, I think you used the word conversation I would use the word conversation, that every GI that comes out should have a mental health conversation. And they have to be told how to cope with life the way it is, because they've been taking orders. They've been told if they're in the foxhole and the enemy is shooting bullets, I want you men, go, jump out of the foxhole and run right into the fire. You're programmed to do that, and your whole life is disciplined that way. When you're back in life, you don't have that. And somehow you think when you get out of the service that you're a hero. You served in these situations, and you're a hero. And all of a sudden you find out, I'm just a regular schlup, and I'm not a hero. And yet people, oh, you served, you must be a hero. And right away, see, that starts working with them, where they feel that they're coming up short. Basically, I think that they really get to the bottom line of all of this, Dr. Huber, is I believe starting in high school, we need to have mental health mandatory classes for all the students. And they have to be presented in a way where, as a student, when you hear that, by the way, 1 o'clock this afternoon, we're having a mental health class, everybody's going to be scared. They don't want to go. They're embarrassed. They don't need this, et cetera, et cetera. They have to be told how to cope with life and the challenges of life, and that it's not wrong to feel that you may come up less than you expect yourself to be in certain situations. That's okay. It's part of life, and you do what you have to do. So I really believe that if we educate students from the high school age to face things and go on, that it makes it easier for people to cope. This one girl, and I mentioned this to you, Bob, years ago, the girl up in Bergen County, she was a track star, beautiful girl, a wonderful student, a soccer star, a track star. She was given a scholarship to a Ivy League school, if you can imagine that. She committed suicide.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, who would ever understand that? But the point is, apparently, she felt in her mind that in spite of everyone looking at her from the outside saying, oh, what a wonderful life this young lady has, herself, she came up short to herself. And that's where we need to be able to give these people the outlet to get help. I know, Doctor, you mentioned some telephone numbers. That's difficult. You know what I mean? It's
oh,
a
it
good
is,
try.
It is. But what?
But, you know. But, you know, you can take it from there.
Yeah, it is difficult. And, you know, if you can find that data, because basically we see that right now that the suicide rates are more stratified based on age than it is socioeconomic status right now. If you can find that, what we do know is money and success are a multiplier. If your life is going great, they make your life even better. But if your life, if you're struggling, it makes your struggles even harder. And it's hard to believe that. But when we see people like Anthony Bourdain, who finally had apparently his life on track and everything going great, and he finally had a mm-hmm. bank full of money, and then he takes his own life, you know, what people mm-hmm. don't realize is, again, that money is a multiplier. And it just, you know, something that somebody else, you know, they don't have to worry about walking into a restaurant and having somebody who knows you start asking you all these questions, and then the next person does too, because they think they know you because they've seen you on TV or they listen to you on the radio station. Mm-hmm. And those things have a burden and a price, but that success, again, is a multiplier. It multiplies your life and how it's functioning at that moment and your perception of it, which is most significant.
Bob, we got to run here, but thank you very much for your patience and for your call.
Yeah, and good luck with your work, Doctor.
Thank you, Bob.
Thank you. Let's do one more call here. Sue in Connecticut, we've only got a couple of minutes.
All I need is a couple of minutes.
Excellent.
The home-based program is a partnership with the Boston Red Sox Foundation and Mass General Hospital. They operate the first and largest private sector clinic in the country dedicated to healing the invisible wounds of veterans and their families. As he said, they wish there was a program. There is. I think they take anyone can call who needs to call. I believe it's a four-week program. It's amazing. And the Boston VA is amazing. And the TAPS, T-A-P-S organization, works with veterans and families and family members of loss. And it is a serious issue. And I've been to Hartford several years speaking about it, and my senior senator is crickets. He's not. They're not. They're really not concerned. Absolutely. On the level where we need it.
Yeah, none of them are, in my opinion.
But truly, contact. You said you want a four-week program. It exists. Home base. As a Yankee fan, it's hard for me to say the Red Sox are doing it, but the Red Sox are actually doing it. So, and thank you.
Thank you for bringing that to our attention, too. I'll definitely look into that and see if we can do something more on in depth on that in an upcoming time. Interesting areas of discussion, as always happens on this program. Dr. John Huber, who is a clinical forensic psychologist, chairman for Mainstream Mental Health, our guest on our program this morning. Now, since we're talking about suicide, and I want to mention those phone numbers again before we close here. We've got about a minute here. For the person who's listening to us today, and they are concerned about somebody considering suicide, or somebody who's listening to us who they themselves are considering suicide, what do you say to that person?
You know, usually when I get called in, I have some kind of background on the person, and that makes it easier for me as a professional. But when you're not a professional, what do you do? And the best thing you can do is get them to tell their story and listen. Active listening. Don't just pull out your phone and start, you know, that's part of the problem.
Update your Facebook.
Yeah, exactly. Right. You know, and active listening. When they say something and you think they said it in a certain way for a certain reason, ask them in your own words.
Right.
You know, is this what you're saying?
Mm-hmm.
And they get clarity. They also get to hear somebody tell them without saying, yes, I'm listening. They actually proved it to them.
Somebody cares.
Yes, enough
that's
to listen.
The other thing. Yes.
And that comes through, and it does so much right there. And don't ever be afraid to call 911. Police are trained.
You mentioned the phone numbers. Do those again for us.
All right. New York City hotline 212-673-3000 and 1-800-999-9999. As well as the 1-888-273-TALK.
Thank you very much for joining us. Wonderful discussion on our program, as I expected it would be. Certainly the best with your work. After our 8 o'clock update, Rick Wolf is along with the Sports Edge program. And, after our 9 o'clock update, how can I describe it? Yeah, I think that pretty much sums it up. Ed Randall will be by. He'll be talking baseball here on The Fan.
It's playoff time in the NBA and NHL. Baseball's in full swing, and FanDuel is your place to bet on every game. Right now, new customers get $150 in bonus bets guaranteed. That's $150, win or lose. Bet on everything from slap shots to home runs to slam dunks, all on an app that's safe, secure, and easy to use. What are you waiting for? Visit FanDuel.com/sportsfan and make your first bet an automatic win. FanDuel, America's number one sportsbook. Must be 21 plus and present in Ohio. First online real money wager only. $10 first deposit required. A bonus issued as non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire 7 days after receipt. Restrictions apply. See terms at sportsbook.fanduel.com. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.